The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. On our last program, we had looked at a section out of the entomology text that we use and simply had noted the author's comments there about the changes to the tissues during metamorphosis. It might be helpful to remind you that these authors are not creationists, they are evolutionists, and yet they are simply dealing realistically with the changes that occur there. We talked earlier, when we were talking about molting, about the actual changes that occur during the molting process. The exoskeleton of the insects is really a hardened material. It is what is known as chitin, at least a technical name for it, a nitrogenous polysaccharide. The basic molecule in the insect exoskeleton is essentially a glucose molecule, the same glucose that you find in starch, but it has some nitrogen atoms attached to it, and the attachment of those makes the molecule very differently. And as we talked about earlier a little bit, the exoskeleton is really very stable. If you have occasion to walk along the beach sometime, you will find that you'll see old crab skeletons or lobster pinchers or whatever lying there. And in some cases, these things may have been there for years. So they're really very stable. And yet, when it comes to the molting process, this is the histolysis that we talked about last time. How that hardened material, by virtue of enzymes, organic chemicals that have the ability to digest the bonds between those molecules, really render it a fluid, a liquid. And then in the process of pupation, these same molecules that form the exoskeleton of the larval stage are simply rearranged and become parts of the exoskeleton of the adult, different in shape, different in appearance. We've talked about how all the muscles have to be reattached, about how the muscle function in the adult is of necessity very different from the immature, the larval stages. The muscles that are necessary to move the wings are very different from the muscles that are necessary to make the little peristaltic contractions that are typical of a caterpillar moving across the lawn or across the sidewalk. And when we start talking about the changes in muscle size and shape and function, there are also obvious changes in nerve connections. The neural connections that are sufficient to cause the muscles to contract in a caterpillar's body are not sufficient to be able to initiate muscle contraction in the muscles that power insect flight. We have talked a little bit about that before. We'll probably spend some time, at least a program, discussing simply the idea of insect flight. I think you'll find it very, very interesting. But the point here is that they're different. So you go from the larval stage to the adult, and the musculature, the numbers and arrangements of those muscles are very, very different. And the changes have been mediated during the pupal stage by instruction from the genetic material, producing the enzymes, appropriate ones, some that will dissolve the old tissue away, some that will produce the same type of tissue, a muscle, for example, but make it longer or bigger or have it attached in a different place. And so that the intercomplexity of this, the interdependence of this, again, is something that just there is no end to. And I remind you again that the idea that these kinds of things could have come into existence initially through an evolutionary process simply do not make any sense. And they are, the general subject that we've talked about is one which the evolutionists much prefer simply to bypass or ignore, because the the potency, the power of the argument, in my opinion, is simply irrefutable. And this gets us to a consideration, at least briefly, of why people would choose to believe it. There must be a powerful reason for an individual to reject their common sense, to reject real science, and to reject biblical revelation and come to a conclusion completely different. And it is basically a desire not to be in submission to a creator. And presumably the simple answer to that then is just reject the idea of a creator. So you can go on in your own way doing whatever it is you want to do without having to worry about the creator. So, and I'm sure there are some evolutionists who really don't go through all this process. They don't sit down and rationally think through this. But it is my opinion that this is one of the potent reasons for a person to reject multitudes of information and come up with a notion that is completely different from what would be the normal conclusion to all of the evidence that is available. Just as you have changes of tissues, muscles of one shape and number in caterpillars' bodies, and muscles fewer actually in the adult body, but much different in structure. How all of that is accomplished through the biochemical processes that we have at least some information about just at least staggers my imagination. Now, we talked earlier, much earlier, about the process of the formation of bodies going from a fertilized egg, a zygote, containing a copy of the genetic material of the male parent and a copy of the genetic material of the female parent, and combining those in the egg itself, and then having the egg hatch, and then begin to go through that process that will ultimately lead to a mature body. There are several stages of embryological development that are usually noted, the morula, the blastula, the gastrula, and how this all of this involves a synthetic or in synthetic processes, which are really the basis of formation of what is going to be present in the adult body. And having taught embryology for some decades, we could spend some time discussing that, probably will, in a series of future programs. But these finally are going to produce what are known as the primary germ layers, the ectoderm, endoderm, mesoderm, bearing in mind that all of these cells have the same genetic material, and yet the processes within the cell are producing very different results. The cells may not look a great deal differently, but if you will leave them alone, they will end up being a great deal different. And this gets us back to a comment about homology, the idea that similarity proves relationship. And they look alike. But the fact is, genetically, that is, as far as the portions of the genetic material used, they're quite different. And then, after these primary germ layers have come into existence, you have the tissues being laid down. And the tissues, in turn, then, are going to begin to form the body systems, so that you start off from a single cell, a single structure, the zygote, the fertilized egg cell, and you end up with your adult body, or your body at whatever stage it happens to be at. And it goes through a series of ordered, predictable changes. We can predict with great accuracy the changes that will occur, when they're going to occur, etc., that are going to take the development from a single fertilized egg cell through all of these stages that we have just talked about to the adult. Final adult, and hopefully at some point we will be discussing a little bit of anatomy and physiology and have some appreciation for what we find in a human body. But all of that has simply come from the genetic material that is encoded in the chromosomes that have come from male and female parents. And if we consider one organism, we've talked about, those of you been around with us for a while, we talked about going through all of the invertebrate animal phyla. These are all very, very different. So that the egg of one type of invertebrate may look very similar to the egg of a different type, but they're not the same. They're different. And an unfailing way to establish that is simply to leave them alone. And if you do that, you don't have any problem with the eggs of a mollusk developing into an insect, or the eggs of an earthworm producing something else. So that there is tremendous complexity and purposefulness within a single organism, but that is replicated in the purposefulness and the complexity of a different organism, which is going through many of the same processes, but the product of those processes is very, very different. And again, this is simply not the kind of thing that a process without an orderer or a patterner involved is not going to produce. We talked about this at some length in an earlier program. Started off as simply as I know how with coin flipping, random processes. And the fact is, random processes do not produce order. And we talked about a number of examples of this kind of thing. That if you're going to approach something randomly, then that random process is not going to produce anything purposeful. And this is a major problem for the evolutionists. This is why many evolutionists, although they will reject the idea of God, then have to come up with some, quote, natural, end quote, replacement for him, such as natural selection or Mother Nature or something. Because if you simply have matter and motion, in matter, motion, and force interacting on one another randomly, you don't have complexity or order produced. And this in itself is one of the most powerful arguments against the idea of evolution.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson @bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.